Well, it is a privilege to be able to share again about this, about music. I hope we aren't musicked out with all the discussion about music. And I'm reminded, as we continue to talk about music and its effect and its role in our lives as Christians, it's like many things in life, it's easy to talk about things and not actually do them. So we can have seminars on evangelism. We can have seminars on family living and things like that, and then have terrible family lives and not evangelize. And we can talk about music and then not sing. And that would be just a crying shame. So we don't want to do that. But there is something to say about attempting to come to a clearer understanding about the issues. Because I think as we look at music, and we try to understand what the Bible says, how Christians have viewed this from times past, and how it's being worked out today in our churches, then it helps us to have a stronger belief. It helps us to develop stronger practices that are going to help us maintain what we feel is really important. So all that to say, it's kind of like a justification, I guess, for taking some time to think about this. I want to finish up the little history that we had started last time, and then Ken gave me permission to make a few more comments at the end, and I have another handout I wanted to give you here when we get to that. So here I'd like to just quickly review where we've been. So we went all the way back to early music, Jewish worship, the synagogues, how that influenced the early church with their a cappella singing tradition. We talked about the medieval period and the Catholic Church, how that was such a large, had such a big influence on music. And since most of the music that was done during that period of time was in the church, then it was Christian. It had Christian lyrics. And many of that, because it was done by trained musicians, has been carried on down today. And we, it actually is beneficial to us. And so that took us to the liturgy of the Mass. Now, also mentioned that the music of the medieval church or the Catholic Church became mostly the music of the trained musicians, of the trained singers, and therefore the congregation didn't participate much. And so that was one of the problems of the medieval church, is that there wasn't congregational singing by and large. Then we talked about the reformers, Zwingli, Calvin, talked about the Anabaptists, the Alspund, and what brought it about. We mentioned Luther. We discussed Luther and also his contribution to music, the chorale. It's said of Luther, I think it's Paul Westermeyer, says, Luther united old and new, high art and folk art, rural and urban, by the chorale itself, which appealed across these lines, and by the ancient principle of alternation. And he goes on to talk about that. I'm just bringing that up again to kind of review what I mentioned that Luther did for the music of the church. So he took the music that was done in the Catholic Church at this time, which was by trained choirs, which was done by trained composers, and he sort of married that with the simple folk tunes that the common person would have known, that the people without musical training, they would have known these simple tunes, and those were the chorales. That's what that was based on. And then he put those together with more of a choral piece. Now, why is that significant? I'm pointing that out because I think that's one of the reasons his hymns some of his music has hung around for a while. It's because it was done well. And we'll get back to that later. A lot of composers out of the Lutheran tradition. Bach, I want to mention just another composer. I think I missed this last time. That was Handel. Handel was not a religious person per se. This humorous. He's known for his gluttony, actually. If you study his life, he was just oversized, we'll say it that way, and seemed to be given to his appetites. But he did write music for the church, because that's what you had to write for if you were going to be a composer. You didn't have a lot of other options during this era. So even though he may not have been a Christian person per se, he was going to write for the church because that's who was giving him the job. It's interesting that Lowell Mason took lines from the Messiah to write the song Joy to the World. If you notice in your hymn books, in Joy to the World, it says Handel. Well, we don't know exactly where that came from, but this is for the more musically inclined, the first four notes of da-dum-da-dum, okay, the opening line of Joy to the World, thing could possibly have come from it's the same as the first four notes in Lift Up Your Heads and Glory to God, those two choruses from the Messiah, if you're familiar with that. Also, the little repeat lines in Heaven and Nature Sing, Heaven and Nature Sing, that could come from the orchestral or the accompaniment on Comfort Ye, My People, the tenor aria. Anyway, just another example of how some of the classical composers, well, he was Baroque technically, but anyway, contributed to our hymnody today. Lowell Mason was, okay, I'm getting ahead. Mendelssohn. I'm still on point number two. Mendelssohn is one I skipped over, and I wanted to bring that in because he was actually a Jew. His father left the Jewish faith, and one of the reasons I'm mentioning Mendelssohn is because we see a number of his tunes in our hymn books. One of them, a lot of times they'll say Mendelssohn Bartholdy. That was actually an attempt with his father to add to their name because he didn't want it to be Jewish. It was like a way to renounce his Jewish faith. But anyway, we see a number of these tunes. One that is familiar to you is Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Now that text was by Charles Wesley. And the original was actually a cantata. Now, I don't think I explained what a cantata was when I talked about Bach. It was actually this, it was built on a chorale, and then you might have had solo parts, and you might have had an organ part, and you might have had choral pieces. And it was all put together as one, sort of like an oratorio, but it was maybe a little smaller. Anyway, it was from a cantata called Festgesang, I guess is how you say it. It's German. Some of you will correct my pronunciation probably. German for festive hymn. And it is a festive piece. But what it was written for was to celebrate an anniversary of Gutenberg's printing press. So it had a German text talking about that event. And, of course, someone else came along, put Charles Wesley's words to it, and it's become one of our favorite Christmas carols. I'm bringing these examples in to show how that the hymnody that we enjoy and that we find so rich today goes back many, many years, many, many people. It's a joint effort. And so that becomes important when whole groups of churches are structuring their entire worship service around the hymnody or the pieces that have been written in the last 50 years. And the question is, why would you do that? When we have rich hymnody that goes back to the beginning of the Christian church, why not include that? Is there some reason why that needs to be kind of pushed off to the side? So, all right. Now we're at point number three. Point number three. Hymnody of the 17th and 18th century. And I just divided this up this way because it was not because of any particular reason except to try to give some sense of the chronology here. So Isaac Watts is such a tall figure. He was in the Anglican Church in England. And supposedly, this is the way the story goes. He was disgruntled with the Psalms that they needed to sing in church. So this was the influence of John Calvin and some of the reformers. They sang the Psalms, and they were word for word as they were in whatever version of the Bible that they were using in church. Like I said, it could have been the King James by this time, but I don't think so. Anyway, so supposedly he said something like let me back up a little bit. He was rhyming things all the time as a child growing up. And evidently it was an irritation to his father. So this is the story as I got it. He's one time said something like this. A little mouse for want of stairs ran up a rope to say its prayers. And supposedly that earned him some corporal punishment from his father for having such a sacrilegious little line. Anyway, and after that he supposedly said, Father, Father, pity take, and I will no more verses make. So I guess it was in his bones. He couldn't get it out. But anyway, evidently his father told him, said, well, if you're dissatisfied with the solemnity in the church, then get us something better. And he did just that. He wrote over 600 hymns are attributed to Isaac Watts. And basically what he did was took the Psalms and paraphrased them and set them to verse. The other thing he did was set them in the language of the New Testament. Now, what this means is that he said the Psalms were written by David before Christ actually came and before salvation was complete. So if we sing only psalmody, we're not getting the full picture of salvation in our hymns, which I think is actually a very important consideration. When we think about our hymns, we need to think about the theology that comes with it. So if all of our hymns are psalms, and I really think we need to get back to the psalms. I think the contemporary church is moving away from psalmody in some senses. But if that is all our music, think of what we're missing about the salvation story. So that was one of his, his attempt was to try to bring it in from a Christian perspective. So if you read his hymns, you can think about how that is actually the case. Psalms were written in the language of the New Testament. Some examples of his hymns are Jesus Shall Reign. And that's what the blank is for. I'll give you several. There are so many of them. And we have them in our hymn books. They're in any hymn book you're going to pick up is going to have many, many of these hymns. As I said, Jesus Shall Reign is one. When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. O God, our help in ages past. Joy to the World, the text for Joy to the World, he penned that. Now, he did use the tunes that were already in use for singing psalms in the Church of England, or it was also known as the Anglican Church. All right, then we move ahead now to John and Charles Wesley. John and Charles Wesley, you know the story possibly of their mother Susanna, and they had a large family. I think about half of them died in infancy, half of the children did. John and Charles, of course, lived to adulthood. And they attribute a lot of the spirituality in their lives to their mother. Well, early in their life, they were labeled Methodists because of their disciplined approach to, disciplined approach to Christianity and to the things of the church, like the church observances and those types of things. And this would have been when they were in college. Well, they began to take hymns from the Bible. They were influenced a lot by the Book of Common Prayer, which would have been the book of prayers in the Anglican Church in England. So that gave them inspiration for a lot of their hymns. It's interesting that when they came to America, they were actually converted by some Moravians that they met. These were Moravian missionaries, and they were really impacted by the Moravian church. Charles Wesley wrote over 6,000 hymns. So we talked about Isaac Watts and 600 hymns. Charles Wesley, probably at least 10 times more than what Isaac Watts wrote. Charles Wesley wrote in a little different time. He was not quite 100 years later than Isaac Watts. And we see the thought of the time represented in his hymns. If you're familiar with world history, you know that this is the romantic, kind of what they call the romantic era, which means that there was emphasis on sentiment or emotion, on nature, those kinds of things. So, for example, look at his hymn, "O for a Thousand Tongues to Sing." Now, I don't know if you've ever stopped to think about what word picture that actually creates. I mean, I have one tongue, and it gets in the way sometimes. What would a thousand do? But it's like this hyperbole or this intense exaggeration to try to get a point across. And that would have been typical of poetry during this time. So it's much more expressive. It's emotion. It would reach out and grab somebody much more quickly than, let's say, Old Hundredth, which came from a psalm, from a psalmody, the Geneva Psalter, which was, "Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise Him all creatures here below," and etc. So it's a little different kind of language. The point here being that every time, every era, every composer, every author writes out of a particular context. So if you write a hymn, you write out of the context of Western society, America. You write out of the Amish or Mennonite or Anabaptist tradition, however you want to say, wherever you fall there. So you write out of a certain context, and it affects what you write, what the themes are, what the language is. Not as in German or English. I'm talking about the vocabulary, things that you, how you express yourself. Okay. Other songs. From Charles Wesley were "Come Thou Long Expected Jesus," and I already mentioned "Hark the Herald Angels Sing." "Love Divine, All Loves Excelling" is another one that's common to us and that we sing. Now, Count Zinzendorf, he was Moravian and very influential in Moravian missionary efforts. He wrote a number of hymns, and I just want to list a couple here. One was "Jesus, Thy Blood and Righteousness." How many of you know that hymn? It's not in our hymn books, which I'm very sorry about. It's one of the richer hymns that we have available to us today. It just talks about Jesus' sacrifice on the cross. And in very descriptive and meaningful language, helps us to understand what that means to us as Christians. "Jesus Still Lead On," I think that's in the Christian hymnal. Okay. Now, we're jumping ahead very fast here. Methodist revivals. This is the 19th century. Now, we have the circuit-riding preachers, and they had these big revivals. A lot of these happened on the frontier. So you had Kentucky, Tennessee, rural areas, and the preachers would come around, and these were Native Americans. They were the blacks or the African Americans. It might have been some slaves, if their masters would let them come, whatever. They would also had white people. A lot of these would have been your more country people. So coming to these camp meetings, songs during these camp meetings. Of course, they wouldn't have had books. They were songs with refrains. They were easily taught to crowds without hymnals. Themes of personal experience. We're going to come back to that later. I'm talking about the African-American spiritual here in this part because of a place to put it, but just understand that the camp meetings, the African-American spiritual, all of that would have happened over the course of 100 years and more, possibly. So the African-American spiritual, that's a part of our hymnody. We have the verse and refrain that comes into the gospel song, and we have a number of those in our hymn books. So this people think comes from the practice of call and response. And this would have been more than just in the African-American tradition, where you would have one person out in the cotton fields and he'd have been singing, and then somebody else or a number of the other workers would have answered in a refrain or in a chorus. It'd been a part that would have been repeated all the time, you know, over and over again. And then he might have sang part of the verse and then they would have answered. Lining out is actually a practice that was commonly done in many traditions before hymnals. And that's basically where one person had a book or he had a song that was memorized. And he would say a phrase or sing a phrase, the congregation would answer. He would sing the next phrase. They would sing that phrase after him, and et cetera. That's how they would learn a song. So this practice was done over a number of traditions. But in the African-American tradition, it could have been this what we call call and response. They had themes of suffering and deliverance, syncopated rhythms, and flatted pitches. They're also called blue notes. If you want to think about the tonic scale, the do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, it's the mi and, the mi and the ti would both be flatted commonly. And it gives it kind of the mournful sound that some of them have. The example just left me. Maybe it'll come back. But anyway, a lot of this, the singing for the African Americans went back to their African roots. All right, singing schools in America. We have William Billings, Lowell Mason, and Joseph Funk. These are just three that I picked out. William Billings was a composer. He was kind of self-trained, but he took psalm tunes that would have been familiar to people, and he had them sung in various parts. So people would sing, like one voice would sing one line, and another voice would come in and sing another line, and kind of this polyphony or this polyphonic type of effect. And then one thing we know about his songs, they were really rough and raw in character. In other words, it was more the type of sound that you would have when you had people getting together in somebody's old barn, and they just would set up house for the evening and have a good old hymn sing. And he would teach them notes and teach them songs, and they would sing rough and hearty as they would after they came in from a hard day's work on the farm, that kind of thing. So it wasn't really cultured. It wasn't refined. In fact, people at the time kind of looked down on William Billings and the music and the music singing schools that he was producing. It was just, they thought it was a little too rough in character. But either way, he got people singing. And that's, I think, notable about William Billings. Lowell Mason comes on the scene as well. Lowell Mason, that's the second one. Simple tunes for the average singer. That's one of his emphases. And Lowell Mason is so important here because he was an educated person, and I mean, he knew music, and he actually went to Europe and got a lot of these really good good music that had been produced in the Catholic Church during this time. He took some of those and adapted them. So, for example, I gave you the example of Joy to the World. He did that type of thing, but put it in a very simple hymn form that was easily accessible to congregations. So that was one of the ways that he contributed well to this church hymnody. He adapted parts of classical works to hymn tunes. The third one is Joseph Funk. The Harmonia Sacra is the book that's associated with him. It was originally called A Compilation of Genuine Church Music. He conducted singing schools with his sons, and he moved to Rockingham County, lived in Singer's Glen, and set up a publishing house. It is incidental that I don't know how you want to say it, but some of the publishing houses that were started as a result of his work many, many, many years later actually published a lot of Southern gospel music, which I don't think was exactly what Joseph Funk had in mind. Also, some of his, because of some of his influence, Shenandoah University, which is also Shenandoah Conservatory up in Winchester, was also formed. The organ became accepted during this time in America. That's in Protestant churches in general. Okay. The 20th century. So much has happened in the 20th century. I want to talk about popular music. So we'll kind of be going back and forth over the 20th century a couple times here. The 20th century, we have popular music. Popular music is generally that which is considered to be done by or that is most popular to a culture. So what would be considered popular music today is the music that makes it up to the single-digit charts, they say. So it's the top 10. Whoever gets on the top 10, whatever that music is, that's the pop music. So understand that the pop music of today is different than the pop music of my generation. My generation's already passed. My generation, which is different from the music, the popular music of, let's say, my parents' generation, which is different from the pop music of their parents' generation. It's changed, 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 changed. It continues to change. It's changed incredibly in the last 10 years, for example. So we're going to recount some of these developments. First of all, we have jazz. Jazz, point one, jazz grew out of urban black settings. So we have post-Civil War, we have the blacks moving to the cities, and they're disgruntled with life, and a lot of the music that they form comes out, has been termed jazz. It had a lot of the syncopated rhythms. In many cases, it had bawdy lyrics. In other words, they weren't the kind you want to listen to. And in some ways, it models a lot of country themes, country music themes, because it was about people's experiences, you know, lost loved ones or oppression of some kind or that type of thing. So there's not a lot of jazz music that is Christian, but there's jazz music that isn't, how would you say, doesn't have bad lyrics. It might not be all that good, but it's not vile. And actually, when it comes to the music of this particular time period, if you heard jazz today, you just like the accompaniment, let's say, of some jazz, you may not actually think it's offensive at all. And it's simply because in comparison with what we have today, it's really fairly tame in its rhythms and that type of thing. I'm not trying to say that there's jazz is what you should listen to. I'm simply trying to put it in its context. All right, rhythm and blues, R&B, rhythm and blues began on the heels of jazz. It had a more insistent beat, so we see an evolution of the music here. Rock and roll, the Beatles and Elvis Presley are two names that we think of there. The Beatles were a British group that came over to America. Again, if you heard the Beatles or Presley alongside of some of the stuff you hear in Walmart or somewhere else today, you would actually think it's fairly tame in terms of its beat. Presley, Daryl already talked about this, one of the things that he brought an outcry from most of culture here in America because of his stage presence. His stage presence had a lot to do with his just vulgar stage presence and movements. So I think that's one thing that's still true about rock music today. Now, alternative rock, and this is just to give one example of how that when you say rock music, you're talking about a huge category. And then there are like 10 more categories that we could kind of narrow down in rock music. There are lots of categories in rhythm and blues. There are categories in jazz. There are categories in contemporary Christian. There are categories in country or Western, those kinds of things. So we're talking in very, very general terms here, and I'm simply bringing in alternative rock to show that that's an advent out of the 90s. And the lyrics are very, very destructive and violent. So it's we see a movement here to very, very bad lyrics. And I think it's just reflecting the values of the time. And then we have rap. Rap has been around for a while, but possibly become more popular in recent years. And this is not a melody. It actually takes a pretty good voice to be a good rapper. You have to be able to have incredible breath control, and somehow there's some kind of technique where you take breaths even though you're still talking or something like that. I haven't mastered it, that art yet. But anyway, it's a music all of its own if you have a fairly broad definition of music. Now, changes in music. I think one of the things we have difficulty identifying with is a culture pre-electricity. The music before electricity, you didn't have recorded music. Let's just go down through this list and then I'll comment more on that. Now we have electronic amplification, number one. Two, we have electronic listening devices. Three, we have electronic instruments. So we have amplification. That means that you can sing to a crowd of thousands and don't need to project your voice. That means you can croon, you can, you know, bite the mic. I'm saying that a little sarcastically. You can eat the mic, whatever. You can get it up close. You can do things with your voice that you would not able to do prior to this time. So you have to think back. In the last 100 years, all these developments have happened. There's a new kind of music now that can happen because of simply amplification. Listening devices. What does this change for us? Suddenly, we can carry music with us wherever we go. Now, when I was little, it was the Walkman, a big old bulky thing that held a cassette and maybe a radio, and then the headset. And we saw people, you know, going around with that type of thing. Well, now you've got iPods, which can have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of songs on them. You can listen to music all day and all night, literally. You carry it on your phone. Okay. Now, that's just talking about personal use, personal listening. You go to town. What do you hear? Music, music, music. I want to have a fine dining date night with my wife. I can't find a restaurant that doesn't turn the music off. I mean, you know, you can listen to music wherever you go. It's dining, it's shopping, it's in the car, it's at home. You know, we hardly need to sing anymore because we have it all into our ears. So that's a big cultural shift that we need to think carefully about, because it is affecting us. It is affecting the way we view music in a number of ways. Okay, so music could now be perpetuated on recording. So you could get music done or performed somewhere, and then you could carry that around with you and listen to it over and over and over and over again. Now, there's something that's different about hearing a song sung hearing a live performance versus hearing it sung on a recorder. When you hear it sung on your CD player or whatever, you're listening to it very, very, very critically without the persona of the performer. And what that allows you to do is listen to the music, make a judgment on it, aside from his personality, from his person. And so one of the effects is that we become very picky eaters. We become very picky eaters. There's nobody, picky listeners. There's no one that can let's say it ups the standard for what we need to have in recorded music. That's one possibility, I think. And so there's the temptation then for a lot of performers today to use all kinds of electronic manipulations to get their voices to be like they should. You have auto tuners where you can sing off key and it comes out right at the other end of the tube, that kind of thing. And the question becomes, okay, is this legitimate? Is this actually real, or is it manipulated? Is it something that's a fake or synthetic? And that goes right along with the electronic instruments. you have instruments that electrically can do lots and lots of different things. They're synthetically produced. And I'm not trying to condemn all of this necessarily. I'm simply trying to help us to think carefully before we just gobble all this up like fast food at McDonald's. You know, we have to think about, is this really what we want for music? Is it changing the way we think about music? And if so, how? One of the other problems that I don't have on your handout, and I want to mention, and that is passivity of listening. So it's you can approach music with more of a passive nature. So you're listening to it all the time. We have lots and lots of listening, but we don't have much singing. So we don't produce music. It used to be, if you were ready for a good music jam, what did you have to do? Well, it wasn't get on the phone either. It was go around and talk to the neighbors or send somebody around, get the neighbors together, have a hymn sing at your house or in the barn, and sing together. You did it that way. Now you just go home and say, all right, get out my favorite CD. There we go. And it can even be private. It can be something everybody else in the house hates. You can put it in here, and then it's your music. You have it in your ears, but everybody else is excluded. So there you had community event, community participation. Now it's individual. It's me, my music. You don't like it? So what? I'll listen to it. It's that kind of thing. So we have this move from community to individualism in our music and listening practices as well. Those are all things we need to think about. Listening requires little engagement from the person that's listening. If you're singing and helping along, that's active. You're engaging your whole body. We begin to think about music as just being this lineup at a smorgasbord. I take what I want, leave what I don't want, that kind of thing. All right, so that's music in our pop culture. Church music. We had the gospel song, and I mentioned the Methodist revivals, D.L. Moody and Ira B. Sankey. We have those men, the Methodist camp revivals, where we had blacks and whites attending, and I'm mentioning that because that formed the music that came out of that period. D.L. Moody and Ira B. Sankey, their revivals, this came toward the end of the century, the 1800s, and again, the characteristics were themes of personal experience, revivalism, cheap grace was one of the things that came out of this, which simply means that, you know, there was an emphasis on getting people saved versus an emphasis on discipleship. So it doesn't mean that it was, we're not trying to discount what Moody did here. I think I need to be careful about how we talk about this. On the other hand, as we look back, we can see an entire movement by hindsight and can make some conclusions about it. And what came out of this was a lot of music that was written very, very quickly. It was written quickly, but the lyrics were fairly low quality in general. The music was also more low quality. It was very, very accessible to the group. So imagine Ira B. Sankey. They said he was a terrific leader, by the way. Supposedly he lost his voice after a few years because he overused it. That's what I read this afternoon. But anyway, he led congregations, or I shouldn't say congregations, groups of people in these evangelistic crusades. This is an example of the kind of story we get from this era. He is riding a train as he and Mr. Moody are going to another revivalist crusade. And he's reading the paper, finds this poem that he finds very, very fascinating. He reads it to D.L. Moody, or says something to D.L. Moody, and D.L. Moody says, well, read it to me, while he's doing something else. And so he reads it with eloquence, and D.L. Moody doesn't pay any attention. He's engrossed in a letter that he's reading. Well, they are at a crusade, and at the end, kind of impromptu, D.L. Moody asks Ira B. Sankey, come up with a hymn. Do you have another hymn you could sing? And so he's thinking real fast, and so he thinks of this little poem he had read and gets down to the keyboard and just started, kind of just hit a chord. It happened to be an A flat. And kind of the first line they say was sort of talking and then sort of singing too, and went through all four verses. Well, would you know it? The hymn is the 19-9. Now, is that the right title? Da-da-dum, ba-dum-bum, bum-bum-bum-bum. And it is in the key of A flat, by the way. Anyway, so that's how that one was put together. Now, people were in tears after that hymn. It was meaningful. And I'm not trying to relay the story to discount the lyrics and any meaning that we get from them as we sing the song. I'm simply trying to say that that was the kind of the way some of this stuff was constructed. So I think for us thinking about the gospel hymn, we need to look at it critically and ask ourselves, is this what we want to use primarily in our church services? Do we want to use this as our primary music? All right. Which, by the way, the Christian hymnal does. It's mostly gospel songs. Gospel concert, then, we have things like the Chuckwagon Gang, Singspiration, Stamps Baxter, and more recently we have Bill Gaither, the Gaither Vocal Group, and there are many, many, many others. But these took the same content for their hymns, for their songs, except they were more performance-oriented. They had a lot of their performances. Now, the feel-good lyrics, and I'm borrowing here from James S. Martin. There, he had an article in the Sword and Trumpet examining the legacy of the gospel song. And he makes a point for this era with the gospel concert. That's what he calls it. He calls it the gospel concert. One of the aspects was feel-good lyrics, and I'm going to just read an excerpt here so that you know what I'm talking about. The concert gospel message became a lot more comfortable with general and sentimental references to salvation. Consider the song Way Down. And it goes like this. I have a feeling in my soul since the Savior made me whole. Way down, way down, way down, way down deep in my soul. All right. Now, that may be familiar to you, it may not. But you get the idea. The lyrics are a little lighter. And, you know, you could ask yourself, is that exactly the picture that you have for the Christian life? Is that how Christ sanctifies you? Well, you may have different answers for that. When we think church music, I think what we need to ask ourselves is, do we want that to be the role model? Is that the three hymns we want Sunday morning? Or is it something that has more thought, more intention, and that the music also has more artistry, is more well developed? Okay, contemporary Christian music, CCM, began with the Jesus movement of the hippies in the 60s. They were also known as the Jesus Freaks. And I remember being astounded when I walked into Sharon Bookstore, for those of you that remember when that was still down in Waynesboro. And I was looking through the music section, and I saw music, and it had some Jesus Freak lyrics in this song. And I just hadn't seen anything like that before. And I was just kind of taken aback. I mean, I wasn't even sure what a freak was to start with. And then to try to figure out what this music was saying. Well, it happened in southwestern California, and there was a couple evangelists went down there, and there were revivals taking place on the streets of L.A. and some of those major cities. And it was in the hippie culture. And a lot of these were Harley Davidson gangs, those kinds of things. And they became Christians. They took their music, and then the church took their music and adopted it. That's where I think the real problem came in. I don't know how to do that. I mean, how do you give credit for people who are sincere and wanting to do what's right, but they still have these residual music and the associations that it brings? So how do you bring them into the church? Well, I think in many cases the church was ready to go out and just get the music. But anyway, the church took the music, and that's where we have our CCM. That's just the story short. It has Christian lyrics, but it's the influence of the pop music of the time. It's rock, praise and worship styles. Again, the themes of the gospel song are prevalent here as well. So when I say, you know, if whole churches are adopting CCM, one of my contentions with that is that you're adopting, by and large, a music from the last generation or two or three. That's it. And so while I think we need new composers, I think that could be a problem. The second thing I think is theology. You need to think about the theology of the hymns. Contemporary Christian has its own theology, and you need to follow that to the end product before you just eat it up. Now, I'm not saying everything is bad about CCM. I'm simply saying I think it's a problem if churches aren't thinking carefully about CCM and what it's doing for their theology about Christianity. In other words, how they think about Christianity and how they think about Christian living. And for some of the same reasons that I just mentioned. Cheap grace. Simple lyrics. And then also the association with tunes that are used in evil places, I think, is another problem. So the music, the setting, and I shouldn't even get in started with that. Daryl already talked about all that. All right. Now, I want to talk just briefly about the choral movement. F. Melius Christensen, he was a Lutheran from Norway in the early 20th century, and his sons Olaf Christensen and Paul Christensen, I bring them in here because they lifted a high standard for a cappella choral music. And in fact, I've heard it said that they're one of the main forces behind America having its own voice in choral works. Carl Schalk is an important composer that you may recognize. John Rutter. Robert Shaw was another. He's not really, I don't know that he was a Christian person, but again, he helped develop this choral art. So the reason I'm saying this is important is because I think choral music lifts high the standard for a culture as opposed to the pop music. The pop music is more like my gut feeling, whatever I want right now, you know, that kind of thing. Choral music, it ennobles. It lifts high. It's something that you don't come by easily. It's not easily accessible. You may have to have repeated listenings. You may have to work hard to get it and produce it, but then you have a more satisfying result, that kind of thing. So I think these are important people, and they've helped shape America's culture, musical culture. Could I have the ushers just hand out the other handout, please? This is just kind of a wrap-up here. I just want to make some conclusive comments while they're doing that. These are just sort of random, I'm sorry. I think one of the things I believe about music is that the congregation does need to be participants in our congregational worship, and I'm thinking here congregational worship. So while I have my opinion, and you probably, if you don't know it, I'll just state it. My opinion about the hymn book situation here in church is that we should probably not use the Christian hymnal so much and maybe bring in another one, simply because of the reasons I've mentioned with the gospel hymn. Having said that, I think it's important for us as a congregation to think about each other's tastes and preferences and to try to be respectful of those. So, for example, whenever you learn a hymn, whenever you sing a hymn, it becomes very, very meaningful to you if you associate it with a meaningful time in your life. So one of the reasons why Amazing Grace is so popular, it's known the world over. It's not because the melody is just so fantastic. It's because of the lyrics and how they are closely associated with a salvation experience. And so many people, that's one of the first hymns they sing, and it's very closely connected with a very, very precious time in their life. And so when you sing Amazing Grace, just think about how many people, churched and unchurched, will join in and sing with you. It's also considered an American folk hymn, so you can actually get by with singing that in public school because it's folk music. But anyway, so my point being that music means something to each of us because of our the experiences that we associate with it. And so I'm not trying to say that gospel hymns are bad. Don't hear me saying that at all. I'm not trying to say that a number of other styles are bad or that you should never listen to a piece like that. What I am trying to say is that we need to be very discerning, particularly when it comes to the music that we choose for congregational worship, because when we choose, we are automatically excluding. So if you choose gospel song, you're excluding hymns. If you choose CCM, you're excluding gospel song and hymns. You might be excluding Psalms. Okay? So remember that your choice does mean you're excluding. And so we need to be careful about our choices in life for that very reason. So I think we need to be thinking about the best. We need to be thinking about, and especially in a Sunday morning service, we need to be thinking about hymns that really do add to the atmosphere is what I'm trying to say. The atmosphere that we want to create in the service. So, for example, I view the sermon as kind of the meat and potatoes meal of the day. It's something that's a lot of thought, a lot of care has been put into. All right, we sit here and we have a meal we're getting ready to get. All right, now imagine music leading up to that being something, I'll fly away, oh glory, okay? That is a little different type of tune. Now, am I saying I wouldn't sing that? Definitely not. Okay, that could be a fine song to be singing around the table some evening. I mean, it's light, and you can argue about the theology or whatever, the text, but to have that prelude, the meat and potatoes that we have here Sunday morning, I think there's much, much better, many, many better choices. And those are the kinds of things song leaders need to be thinking carefully about as they set the mood, set the tone. They need to realize that they are leading the feeding of the congregation. They're not preaching, but they're choosing, they're leading, and they need to be thinking carefully about how they're doing that. Now, your handout. I borrowed this from Steve Byler. I'd come across it about 8 years ago at music camp. And for me, it helped to give a context for the broader picture of music. And that's the idea that there is an objective standard for beauty. There's an objective standard for truth. There's an objective standard for goodness. What objective simply means that it is a standard that is outside of our own experience. It's outside of our definition. So it's like this. If you're grading compositions, you can put down a subjective grade, which simply means you just kind of put down a grade that means how you felt at the moment. So if you had a stomach ache, you might have put an F down or something like that. Objective means that you had criteria you were going by. There was something outside of your own feeling about this. All right. So an objective standard of beauty means that there is something beautiful somewhere, and it is a standard that we can go by. That flies in the face of a lot of CCM arguments, which say it's just your taste. You don't like that music. It's just your taste. I like this music. It's my taste. Okay? It's not so much saying something, making a statement about CCM or any other style or genre of music as it is saying that, yes, there is the standard. And we believe this in other areas of life because we believe that the world began with God. So Jesus Christ is the center of this circle on your handout. We believe that everything that is good in the world, everything that is beautiful in the world, everything that is true in the world finds its perfect expression in Christ. He is the one that lived this perfectly on earth. Okay? Then we have God's revealed word. But that takes a step out because we have problems like translation. I mean, I remember Milo Zaire saying years ago, he said he was studying Greek in college and they're in one class and they're discussing a passage and the alternate interpretations of this particular phrase. And one of the students finally said, so you're telling me that in the Greek, this could either mean this or it could mean this. And the professor said, well, yeah, we just don't know for sure what that word meant in the Greek. You know, we have too much time in between. So there are certain words that we don't know for sure. Well, the student left the class. It was disconcerting to him. It's like it shook his whole foundation about the word of the infallible word of God. Well, it doesn't have to do that. What I'm saying is there are discrepancies between translations, for example. We believe God's word, as he spoke it, is infallible. But then there are could be potential problems with translation issues, for example. So that moves out a step. We've lost a little bit. We have imperfections here. Then we have the creation. Now, the creation was perfect when God created it. But as you know, there's been the fall. So lions eat little lambs nowadays. And the dog gets the bunnies out under the bush. And people hurt each other. You know, that kind of stuff happens, and it's bad. It's the fall. So we have less perfection as we move out from Jesus. We go then to the creation of the created. And that's, you and I are the created. And so we create poetry. We write literature. We sing songs. We compose hymns. We, all the things that we create, and you, we're talking about music, but you could take this into growing flowers and making furniture and producing a nice farm. So the problem is that we're fallen, and in each of these consecutive circles or concentric circles, we have less perfection. Now, we believe, though, that truth, goodness, and beauty are found in the person of Jesus Christ. That's your first blank. Truth, goodness, and beauty are found in the person of Jesus Christ. We also believe that beauty exists. We also believe that beauty exists outside of. Beauty exists outside of ourselves. Beauty exists outside of ourselves and can be assessed for its qualities. In other words, there is a standard. Thirdly, beauty evokes desire. That's one of the things we know about beauty. So if you hear a beautiful song, how many of you, I'm sure all of you, have been in a context where you've heard something done really well, and you just said, that was moving. All right, that's what we're talking about. It evokes desire. You might see a tree. You might see something that's well-crafted. You say, that is beautiful. It is some superficial. So what that means is sometimes we have ulterior motives, or in other words, maybe we're glorying in the person or we're glorying in our own ability, and sometimes it goes on and glorifies God. Next, beauty crosses cultures. It crosses boundaries. All cultures consider some things ugly or beautiful. So in other words, all of creation knows what it means when we talk about beauty. Beauty places value on the material. So what this means is that we're talking kind of abstractly about beauty. It's this something somewhere outside of our experience, you know, and it's found in Jesus Christ. But Jesus became man. He became one of us in the incarnation. And we saw through the Gospels who he was, how he lived, what was true, what was good. And through his interactions with people, we saw that beauty. What I'm going to want to say is the music we listen to, that we sing and that we compose, must correspond with the character of Jesus. So when you're listening to your music, ask yourself the question, does it edify? Is it good quality music? Is it good? Is it beautiful? Is it true? Does it have associations with evil? What are the lifestyles of the performers that people associate with the music you listen to? You know, so if one of the problems with a lot of the pop musicians is that they really do cater to a wide cross section of people. So they'll be singing some Christian stuff, but then they'll sing stuff that really has vile and violent lyrics. And the reason is because they're trying to sell their albums. They simply are about the commercialization or about reaching the top 10. And so we need to remember that that's guiding their choices of the music they sing. It's guiding their performance practices, and it's guiding the way that they present themselves on the stage. All right. Again, I've taken entirely too long to say something. Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this music and the issues that it brings up for us. I really do care deeply about it, and I'm happy for the opportunity we've had to have some dialogue.